This is the first in a series of interviews with Tom Krademacher on his latest book, Confessions of a Secular Jesus Follower, Finding Answers in Jesus for Those Who Don't Believe, published by Convergent in 2016. Tom is an award-winning USA Today columnist who is the communications director at Yale Divinity School. I'm Paul Lewis Metzger, and it's been a privilege for me to know Tom, actually for many years, as a precious friend and vitally enriching dialogue partner. Our conversations date back to our days of living and working in Portland, Oregon. His move to the East Coast hit me hard. You don't have to agree with Tom to find him one of the most agreeable people you will ever meet. His human dignity, honesty, and civility are precious commodities in short supply and great demand in our society. Tom, thanks so much for joining us for these series of conversations that we're having on contemporary culture and the Christian faith.
You're very welcome, Paul, and I should be thanking you for a couple of things. One of those things for which I should thank you is having this conversation with me today. But going back to when this book was originally conceived, I have to thank you for a role that you played in that, too. I don't know how well you remember it, but during one of those infamous lunchtime conversations we had at Milo's, I first uttered out loud that phrase, secular Jesus follower. We had so many great conversations, and they were the kinds of conversations where we'd lead each other to new insights, maybe new language for describing things. That was certainly the case with me.
Absolutely, for me too.
And I really miss it, so I'm trying to imagine that we're in Milo's right now and having one of those conversations, although this time there are a few more people listening to us.
That's correct.
Difference.
Well, thank you, Tom, and it's always a privilege and a delight to interact with you. So we're back in Milo's, at least in our minds. Tom, as we proceed, you confess to follow Jesus as a secular person. Many people of various ideological stripes will find this claim counterintuitive, possibly self-contradictory. In your estimation, why might that be?
Paul, there was one reviewer, I think it was a blogger, who had a real problem with the book, and he used a kind of an awesome term for the problem he had with it. He said that my enterprise and my book are a radical act of decontextualization. And I really get it. I mean, I understand that some people respond that way. It's a provocative and unusual claim. It's interesting. I get this from both sides, but in different ways, as well as a lot of appreciation and a lot of positive response, too. But both the adamant atheists, as I like to refer to them, as well as some Christians, have a problem with this radical decontextualization. And it has a lot to do with babies and bathwaters, you might say. You know, the adamant atheists, they want to throw out the baby and the bathwater.
Right.
Even though I make it very clear in the book that I'm talking about engaging with this figure of Jesus in a secular way, they just can't get there. They see Jesus being so inextricably bound up with Christianity, with a Christianity that they find objectionable, that they're like, no way, you can't talk about Jesus this way as a secular person. And then there have been conservative Christians who have had a problem, too. They don't want to throw out either the baby or the bathwater. And they basically say that to follow Jesus in a secular way just makes no sense. And my response is fine. I'm practicing what I would term Jesus-style non-defensiveness in dealing with people who may have these beefs with the book. I mean, it's not that surprising. But it has been heartening to get a lot of really positive responses, too, and encouragement. And I've met so many people over these past 8 months or so who have been like, yeah, you know, that's sort of been me all along, and I appreciate the way that you've articulated this and, you know, made it more available and well thought out for me. So that's been gratifying, too. But at any rate, what a range of responses.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Maybe we'll have opportunities in future conversations to discuss further the reception from various audiences to the book. And as I've known you for years and some of your books, other works that you've published, in addition to your USA Today column, posts, you know, it's really quite striking to me how people have responded, including evangelicals, the evangelicals you don't know, and onward Christian athletes. So I'm just really encouraged that you're continuing to find people from diverse cultural contexts, engage in your work, and you're really a bridge figure in so many ways, and I'm also thankful for that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You are, too. I do think it's kind of fun and interesting and exciting, but it's also unnerving at times. I mean, you do subject yourself to flack. You brought up evangelicals. One thing that's been fascinating about this experience with the book is that evangelicals were instrumental every step of the way in getting this book off the ground and making it real. I just mentioned a minute ago how one of those amazing conversations between you and me led to my first uttering that phrase, secular Jesus follower. I'm not blaming you.
No,
too much credit.
I know, I'm honored.
There's another evangelical friend of ours who sort of put me up to doing a book about it after I'd shared that conversation with him and talked about my high regard for Jesus. That was Tony Kriz, who basically said, yeah, this should be your next book, Tom, go for it.
Absolutely.
And then another evangelical we know back in Portland, Matt Michalatos, was the one who introduced me to his agent, and his agent, also an evangelical, took on the project with me and helped me get the contract with Convergent at Penguin Random House, and that acquisitions editor has always had a relationship with the evangelical church.
Fascinating.
So evangelicals, every step of the way, helped make this happen, and I think it's because evangelicals, at their best, are first and foremost about Jesus.
Mm. Well, thank you, Tom. And I certainly hope that we are really and truly about Jesus. And I think your book helps to exhort us to really think through our claims as it relates to Jesus. So again, many thanks. You're not an either-or guy. I think that's fair to say, which means you don't believe one has to adhere to Chalcedonian credo Christology or Christianity to follow Jesus, or to reject other paths to follow him. However, you do not think all paths are equally meaningful or beneficial, such as consumer capitalism. Could you unpack this point from your introduction, please?
I do. I mean, I will. And when I sort of take stock of what's happening in the secular sphere, which I'm very involved in now, and more directly than ever because I'm involved with the Yale humanist community, and with the national humanist community. When I take stock, one of the ideas that I see and hear being articulated is that secular people think for themselves. We reach our own conclusions about the ultimate nature of things, our take on faith, on politics, on ethical issues, that we don't just accept handed down doctrine or truth or wisdom. And so I think that's partially true, but as I take up really directly in the epilogue of the book, I do think that many of us who say that we just follow our own instincts and ideas really are led by some other things. We really do follow, but often it's unconscious. And when I say that, I'm thinking mainly about things like consumerism, capitalism, business as usual in the way we live our lives in this particular decade and in this cultural context. So, as I say in the epilogue, it's not that we're as free of shepherds as we secular people might think. And often we are following things. And my take is that it's better to be awake and to really think about what we're following, be intentional about what we're following, and to choose well. And it's okay to follow. I mean, why should we be so prideful about always figuring everything out from scratch and for ourselves when there are when there's great wisdom from the ages and from many sources that can be tapped and to give us a head start on these things and maybe even to give us a fairly complete map? So that's a part of what I'm trying to do with this book, is really challenge the idea that we always follow our own ideas. Let's be honest that we do follow things. And let's choose well and follow well.
Thank you, Tom. And I'll ask you to define some terms here in just a minute. But before we do that, as I mentioned a bit earlier, you're
I know we're going to be editing this, so can I add something to this? I skipped part of your question.
Oh, well, go ahead. Go ahead. And we're not editing it. We're gonna post it as is. So it's very raw footage, if you will. But go ahead. Go ahead and
please add. Okay, it's raw like rock and roll. That's awesome.
Right. That's right.
The rawer, the better.
Go ahead.
There's one chapter in the middle of the book that is called Saved From What? And it takes up the notion that the way Christianity is often framed for us in our culture, it's the proposition, it's the claim that Jesus saves. Mm. And I fear that for many people who are not steeped in the church, that just leaves people cold. They don't really quite understand what that means. And when they explore it a bit more, they find out they might be saved from something that isn't a concern of theirs, like, well, hell. And the idea that Jesus saves just seems like an unhelpful abstraction. So be it. But there is a lot to the notion, if you look at it from a different angle, a lot to the notion that Jesus actually can save us. He can save us secular people if we look carefully at his ethics and his approach to life. And one of the things he can save us from is a life wasted on, you know, shallow consumerism or trivial self-seeking, self-obsession. That's so important because I think a lot of us can fall into that. Mm-hmm. And I conclude that chapter by saying, yes, Jesus can save us. He can save us from a life wasted on living only for ourselves and our trivial self-concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating. And, you know, with that, I recall you indicating that hell can actually be a daily state of affairs.
I talk in the book about some of the translating I do when I grapple with Christian concepts and Christian language. And so, sure, I can see a way that hell is real and operative in lives today. Mm-hmm. And the same is true of many other Christian concepts and forms of Christian language. But that, to me, it would be hell to perhaps be on your deathbed. Your final moments are ticking away. And suddenly you have this realization that you've wasted your life on just really silly and pointless, selfish things. And maybe you have this moment of realization that really the best life and the most well-lived life has a large component devoted to others, being with others, serving others, and then it's too late to have done anything about it, and you missed out. Hmm. That sounds hellish to me. Hmm.
It reminds me of, I believe it was the maker of Breaking Bad who said, I'm not sure if I believe in heaven, but I definitely believe in hell. And he was talking about, you know, the state of affairs, no doubt that he's chronicling even in Breaking Bad. And I think that there is, you know, real merit in what you're saying. Well, I would say it's not only this life, but there is an eternal dimension to it beyond this life that Orthodox Christianity through the centuries has accounted for. But having said that, I think that it is really intriguing how you get at consumerism and consumer capitalism that so often people fixate and devote themselves to that and miss out on, you know, substantial existence and meaningful existence. And that's not just for secularists, I would add. You know, I think as Christians, we often claim to worship Jesus, but how often are we really materialists in disguise? So I think it's something that even comes home and challenges us that, you know, do we really hold to our claims about Jesus, or do we grasp this life for all we can get from it in a kind of materialistic way? Let me ask you at this point, Tom, if you would please, to define secular, Jesus, and follower, respectively, since your title is Confessions of a Secular Jesus Follower, Finding Answers in Jesus for Those Who Don't Believe. So, again, secular, Jesus, and follower in that order, if you would, please.
Okay, let's do some unpacking here, Paul. So I choose to use the word secular when I describe my own religious identity. Atheist does not describe me. I don't consider myself an atheist. I don't have the anti-religious sentiments that are associated with that word and with that stance. So I use secular in hopefully a flat, non-insulting, relatively baggage-free way of saying non-religious. I mean, obviously, secular is also used to describe a certain kind of relationship between church and state. I'm using the colloquial meaning, a.k.a. not religious. So that's really important, though, because in understanding the claim in my book, it's really crucial to always remind yourself that I'm talking about secular Jesus following, and that's what makes sense of it. So that's secular. And how do I define Jesus? That's really important, too. So some people assume that I'm talking about the historical Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And I over the course of my adult life, I've often read about the historical Jesus. This has been a strong interest of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I even attended a Jesus seminar event once in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guys who would sort of vote with different colored balls to try to ascertain which statements attributed to Jesus were historically accurate or not.
Well, and even Marcus Borg, who was here in Oregon, and you knew him,
yeah,
and knew his work,
was
and I did as well.
Friend and conversation partner
right,
of mine,
right.
And it's so sad that he died prematurely.
Yes, yes.
But, so, as interested as I have been in the historical Jesus, for this book and for what I'm trying to do now in my life, that is not what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
In some contexts, I've said that the Jesus I'm engaging now is face value Jesus.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not talking about the divine Son of God Jesus, but I am talking about the Jesus of the New Testament, the Jesus who says and does stuff on the pages of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm setting aside for right now concerns about the historical accuracy or the journalistic accuracy of these stories or these statements that are attributed to him. For what I'm doing now, it doesn't matter whether it's journalistically accurate. I'm just interested in what I can learn from it. And so I'm focusing hard on the things that Jesus taught, or that he is reported to have taught and said, and trying to figure out how to implement it in my life. And that includes the things I go through day to day as an individual person, but also how I engage with the biggest issues in our culture as a citizen and as a writer. And that's what's interesting and vital and valuable for me right now. Face value Jesus, the Jesus who says and does stuff in the New Testament. And so you asked about what I mean by follower. Well, I've been hinting at it in my attempts to unpack secular and Jesus. But what I mean by it is someone who's trying to emulate Jesus, the way he interacted with people, the way he comported himself in difficult situations. For example, the way he loved even his enemies. So I'm trying to emulate these things, work out how to do them in my own life. And I'm trying to be as idealistic and principled about this as I can. It's far from perfect. Most of my Christian friends will tell me that their following is imperfect too. But it has been transformative, and I can cite examples of how I've come to engage with vexing issues and challenges in different ways. That's what I mean by following
mm-hmm.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom, for those definitions, and perhaps in future conversations we'll be led back to them for further exposition, if you will. But why don't you think atheism leads us... While you don't think atheism leads us down a path of anarchy or debauchery, for example, you do think our secularist age has flattened out meaning. While doom is not on the horizon, gloom and boredom are daily struggles. Would you please develop this thought?
Sure. It's a subtle thing that I'm talking about here, Paul. If you look at some of the most inflammatory right-wing rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
you'll hear that people without God are living lives of nihilism, complete debauchery, no moral meaning whatsoever. And if you just look around and talk to people, you see that that is so incredibly exaggerated. It is not like that. But it's not to say that there isn't a problem. I mean, I'm thinking now about a portrayal that I heard once from Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty fame. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yep.
And he talked about, he imagined a scenario where an atheist family had a home invasion and they were all being murdered, but they would have no basis to object because they had no morality. I mean, could it be any more melodramatic than that?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I say in the conversations I'm having and what I say in the book is that, no, it's not like that. What's going on is so much more like prosaic and subtle and maybe even boring than that. So Charles Taylor, who's this oft-quoted author and philosopher and who wrote A Secular Age, I think he describes it really well, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about a flatness that can be perceived in our secular age. And in secular lives. You know, the world used to be enchanted in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a given that God infused everything. You know, I'm talking about, I guess, Europe in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's fair to say that the world is disenchanted. And I guess another way to phrase it is that the magic is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, secular people would say that, okay, that's good. It's better that we have an accurate understanding of the world. And I would probably agree with that, but I would be honest in saying that there is kind of a vacuum where religion recedes from culture or from our lives. And it's not that we're bad people and just like double-crossing everybody or killing people or like sleeping with everybody other than our spouse. But I do think there can be a lack of inspiration and meaning and really powerful ethical input. And I'm interested in exploring what that looks like. And I'm interested, too, in participating in this new project to try to, like, start filling that vacuum in a secular way. And we're beginning to see the early stages of that project where the secular community, where the humanist community is getting more organized and forming community and working on living intentionally and identifying our ethics and living up to that. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a crisis, but there is a subtle thing going on that leaves us wanting for more in our attempt to develop really meaningful and well-lived lives of flourishing.
Yeah, I appreciate very much how you're reflecting on the various compartments or components, aspects of what make life what it is. Truth, goodness, beauty are all things that you're accounting for in your reflections here, you know, which goes back to Plato and the Greeks. Truth, goodness, and beauty, and you know, the pursuit of that entails human flourishing. We won't have an opportunity to get into this today, but even as you mentioned that, you know, my imagination is sparked, and my mind goes back to even Immanuel Kant's struggle with how does he unite the realms of truth and meaning and goodness and beauty, and his three critiques are attempts at accounting for all three domains or dimensions. And even when it comes to the matter of, you know, how do we deal with meaning in life, or is everything reduced to matter and inert matter, he proposed art as a means of bridging the gap between truth and goodness. But the question is always poised is that an intrusion? Is it imposed from without in a way that really isn't able to connect the dots? And I think we're all struggling. It's not just the secularists, but even those who would hold to some form of traditional sacredness. How do we account for bridging the gap between truth and goodness? Is it through beauty? Is it through some other means? And so perhaps we'll have opportunity to get into that more in the future. As with secular humanism generally, you believe society is, quote-unquote, proving people can be, quote-unquote, good without a God. You also wish to go all the way back to Jesus' example and teaching stripped of theology, doctrine, and present-day political appropriations to the extent that that is possible. And there was a quotation there as well. And there's a lot here I have, but I'm going to break it up into several components.
Sure.
The words proving, quote-unquote, and, quote-unquote, to the extent that it is possible, linger in my mind and lead me to ask a question that nags at me, Tom.
Sure.
Are you not drawing from borrowed capital? And the title of this particular post that I have that'll be appearing at my blog at Pathos, Uncommon Cod, Common Good, and at New Wineskins' own blog, is Jesus, Borrowed Capital, ? In Consumer Capitalism, an interview with Tom Krademacher. And so that point on borrowed capital, are you drawing from borrowed capital, Tom, just in terms of
yes.
This discussion?
One word answer.
Well, on to the next one. Do you want to elaborate?
Yeah. Going back to proving what I mean by that the secular sphere and many secular people are proving that people can be good without God. So that's not really all that big a claim. I'm saying can be. I'm not saying they will be. I'm not saying they're inherently good. I mean, I'm very ambivalent about these things.
Mm-hmm.
I could go either way in whether, you know, people in general and secular people in particular are always going to be good. Often they're not, but that's true of all human beings. So, again, I'm talking about the idea that they can be, and I think we see over and over again that there are instances, many instances, in which secular people do good things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that anything there is so bold or complicated. But
so proving wasn't meant.
I'm borrowing from. Go ahead, Paul. What did you say?
So proving wasn't intended in some kind of literal manner.
No, it's more like in terms of providing evidence for the proposition that secular people can be good without God.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I see it over and over again.
Sure. So do I.
And I'd like to think that there are some instances in which I'm being good. Not that I'm just falling short. But borrowed capital, yes, absolutely. This came up in a recent panel discussion I was part of. And I'll say now what I said in that panel, that someone like me, who is finding so much meaning in the figure of Jesus, owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to the church and to Christianity. I mean, let's face it, there would be no Jesus for me to follow in 2017, even in my secular way, if not for Christianity and if not for the church. Because the church is the entity that kept this story going for all these centuries. And so much of the story is important and amazing. And my life is richer for having been exposed to Jesus. You know, when I was a kid, nominally Catholic kid, and now in my middle age, when I'm really focusing on the meaning and ethics of Jesus and finding that as I incorporate them more and more into my life becomes richer and more meaningful. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Borrowed capital. Is it sustainable? Is it going to run out? That's the fear, right? As Christianity recedes further, how long will this capital continue to be available and continue to inform and inspire the culture? I mean, there are so many things that Christianity has given culture, not just Jesus, but really important philosophical concepts like human dignity, philanthropic love. Will these things fade away with the institutional church if indeed the demographics continue? Well, I certainly hope not.
Very good. Thank you, Tom. And again, I'll no doubt come back to this theme because I think it's a very important one, not only for your book, but for us in our society today, the theme of capital and borrowed capital. And you know, I'll draw attention here in a little bit to a figure from a non-Christian tradition and how he looks at the theme of justice. But before that, while I think that there are many good atheists, many of whom put a vast assortment of theists to shame, no doubt, including myself at points, I also reason that they do not have sufficient grounds for their practices or to safeguard meaning. So I'm not sure what you mean by proving, and you've already, in a sense, answered that because these questions were framed in advance of our conversation, and you're saying, you know, you're not to be taking it literally. Here I'm reminded of Nietzsche and William James and philosopher Edward Craig, in a book that he had written on modern philosophy, said Nietzsche was not as optimistic as James was in terms of the merits of pragmatism, so to speak. That for Nietzsche, any concept or conviction or belief that is held for pragmatic reasons is halfway to its abandonment, and nihilism is always right around the corner. And so I don't think the nihilistic concern, or I don't want to use the word charge at this point, but the concern about that is easily dismissed. And I think Nietzsche himself, whom I have the greatest respect for, he was such an honest atheist and a very robust atheist, but he always understood that nihilism was always a pressing challenge for him. And I think you're aware of that as well. But that being said, I don't think that, you know, this word proving, however it's to be taken, is something that's easily understood or is worth discounting so quickly as a consideration item. Maybe you want to come to that, but before I do that, let me ask this question. Moreover, to what extent is it possible to separate Jesus' actions and teachings from his belief about his Father, the kingdom of God, and himself? Because, again, I think that those things are so integrated in the surface reading of the biblical text. But maybe you want to take those up separately.
Yeah, well, I do want to talk about what I would term the sustainability or the sourcing of secular, quote-unquote, goodness. I remembered a brief conversation you and I had about this one of the last times we were face-to-face. It was at the Christ in Cascadia conference just before I moved 2.5 years ago. I just had a column coming out where I said that, you know, I don't care what the source is, as long as people are doing good and moral things, I'm in favor. Mm-hmm. And then you and I exchanged a few ideas about whether secular acts of goodness have adequate sourcing, to use mm-hmm. my language. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an unanswerable question right now. And I'm not 100%
sure
that.
Answerable or unanswerable?
Sourcing secular goodness is a dodgier thing than Christian acts of goodness. I mean, there's such a robust body of tradition and philosophy and ideas that Christians tap into when they serve. And above all, Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. What could be more obvious than that? And so, as I've been saying, yes, I think secular people are capable of doing and being good. And it's good to see the beginning of a project around the country for people to work on that. And I'm part of that, and I'm happy to be there. That's very important. I don't know if it's going to be as robust or as consistent as what we see from Christians at their best. And you and I both know Christians who are amazingly committed and idealistic and do difficult things almost every day to live up to the calling of the Savior. And seculars don't have something like that. So it's not yet known. This whole thing is so new. I mean, I will say that there are philosophies and ideals that secular people tap into, and these can be very meaningful. And they can really motivate them and fire them. I don't think that seculars are always amoral. And all over the place, when we look around at what's happening in politics, the implementation can be botched, but often the most fired-up liberals and seculars are tapping into deeply held beliefs and philosophies, secular philosophies, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know if this stuff is going to be as sustainable or as deeply and well-sourced as what we see from Christians. So that's my answer to that.
Yeah, and I before we get into the other about the biblical narrative and the like, as I said at the outset of our interview, I always appreciate your honesty, you know, that you're willing to just be straightforward. You know, one, I don't know the answer to this, and I would hope I would have the same kind of honesty, because, you know, I certainly have my questions, even as a Christian, about some of the things that I believe and maintain, and I think that's just part of our human journey. That being said, I just want to go back before we take up the biblical narrative piece that I alluded to earlier, and I cannot say enough in the strongest terms, it deeply frustrates me when Christians make claims such that atheists cannot be good people or what have you. You know, you alluded to a certain claim earlier. And while I resonate with the statement that if there is no God, there's no meaning, ultimately, I think that it doesn't mean that atheists don't live meaningful lives. And I do believe that there are, as I said earlier, very good people who renounce Christian faith or other transcendent faith claims, whether it be Muslim or the Jewish faith tradition, etc. But I still think that there is the borrowed capital that we have to account for that a lot of secularist people are drawing from in our society. And just, I wanted to allude to this, if you don't mind, Tom. I mentioned that I would come to a non-Christian scholar other than Nietzsche. While Paulo Rahula, leading Buddhist scholar, had said in one of his books that the term justice is ambiguous and dangerous, and in its name, more harm than good is done to humanity. And we don't have time to unpack that, but, you know, we have a lot of talk on human rights and, you know, the theme of justice that many Americans, no matter what their religious stripe, hold dear. And some traditions look askance at that or look down on that notion. And it's not as if there isn't robust ethics in Buddhism, but rights, human rights, justice, are not void of the anchorage in the Western context, apart from the Judeo-Christian faith. And I think you're well aware of that. And I appreciate that you're seeking to come up with alternative foundations that might provide similar grounding. I appreciate that pursuit, that struggle. But I do think that until you can provide that, I'm still asking the question, still begging the question, or the answer to the question.
Well, is
that even possible?
It's a challenge to this new and growing secular community and humanist community. I'll tell you what haunts me. It's something that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks said, I believe, last summer when he was accepting the Templeton Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke about what happens when civilizations and cultures fade or fall apart. He talks about things that are part and parcel of that, like growing inequality and growing conflict. But then he has this term that really has stuck with me and that, as I say, has somewhat haunted me. He says part of it is that old beliefs fade and there's nothing to take their place. And I see that happening. You know, this relates to what you've been saying about the borrowed capital of Christianity. And I think we probably agree in view of the demographics and the growing disaffiliation from religion in the Western world that for many people, the old beliefs are fading or have faded, but we can't say that something robust has taken its place. And this is problematic. This is worrisome. And to me, this is the challenge. This is the call. This is the summons for the humanist community that I've become more a part of. And this is a message that I've been sending in the articles I'm writing and the talks that I'm giving. We'll see, Paul. I mean, we won't know for a long time how this works out. But it could be really bad. It could be really awesome.
Yeah, and I look forward to staying a part of the conversation. I think it's an important one. So thank you even for this conversation now. Just basically two more questions, Tom. Moreover, to what extent is it possible, and I stated this earlier, but I'm just coming back to it now, to what extent is it possible to separate Jesus' actions and teachings from his belief or beliefs about his Father, the kingdom of God, and himself? Because for the purposes of this book, as you said, you're not trying to go back to what you take to be the historical figure of Jesus apart from the New Testament text, but really just accepting it on its own terms for the purposes of your volume. So, given that, the Jesus that we have disclosed in the New Testament, how do you move forward where you separate, it seems to me, Jesus' actions and teachings from his belief or beliefs about his Father, the kingdom of God, and himself? How is that even possible?
You're probably going to be mad at me for the way I answer this because it might sound glib.
Okay.
But if you're claiming to do this in a secular way, it is eminently possible and more than doable. Because as I alluded to earlier, when you use that qualifier, secular, it's just natural and easy. You just pick and choose. It's not all that dissimilar from people what people have done over the ages, like Thomas Jefferson, for example. And so you say, is it possible? Or to what extent is it possible? And I would say, possible for whom? I mean, for an Orthodox Christian, no, it's not possible. It really doesn't make any sense. And maybe for a super adamant atheist, this separation doesn't make any sense. But if you're saying that you're going to engage with this figure in a secular way, that makes it all possible and logical. I mean, I know it's a new and crazy and provocative claim, but that's what makes sense of it. When I say this, I realize that, you know, this is not going to be approved by Orthodox theology or from the ideas of churches. And that's okay, because if someone says that they're doing this in a secular way and they're outside of the boundaries of church, they can't really be heretical and they really face no reprisals because they're not looking for acceptance or for any legitimacy from a church. As I say in the book, if you're not looking for that, you're free to engage with this figure of Jesus or any other biblical concept as you wish. So that is not the problem. The problem is that you might do it in a way that really sucks and that's totally lame and self-serving. So that's where I think the conversation gets really, really interesting, because it could end up being as thin and light as a piece of paper, utterly meaningless, this Jesus following that I'm talking about or that other people inspired by Jesus might be talking about. And that's why we need to sort of emulate the practices and structures of churches, for example, where there's practices and there's ritual and there's community and there's conversation. So that's my shtick about that, Paul. I hope that you're buying it. I'm super curious what your response is to that.
Well, yeah, with all due respect and appreciation and admiration, I don't buy it at all. But let me just say this in response, and I hope you can appreciate this as well. I'm not trying to be glib either. When I think of Jesus, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, just taking it at face value and in other contexts where he talks about loving your enemies, you know, don't love just like the heathen do, loving their friends. Love as God does, where God loves his enemies. If there is no God for Jesus, I think the ground that he's building his argument on, from just the vantage point of looking at the psychology of Jesus disclosed in the text, there is no ground for loving one's enemy from his vantage point. So to me, it's not logical, if I'm accounting for his own, shall we say, psychology, his own form of argumentation. Or when Paul says, you know, if there is no resurrection from the dead, 1 Corinthians 15, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. I think Christianity is the greatest cause of nihilism once you remove Jesus' grounding in his Father or in the kingdom of God that he really has confidence is disclosed in his person and will be disclosed fully at the end of history, or the Apostle Paul's belief in the bodily resurrection from the dead. I think Christianity is the greatest cause of nihilism, and not allowing for a kind of affirmation of human dignity, that's the last thing I'd want to be as a Christian if those things are removed, namely belief, Jesus' belief in the Father, the kingdom of God, and even his claims about himself in the Sermon on the Mount. But maybe we'd have a chance to come back to that at a future point, because I just feel like those are not questions that are easily answered for any of us, and I don't mean them in any way glibly as a comeback on you, Tom.
No, sure, but I totally respect what you're saying, and this is completely consistent with the wide reading I've done about Christian theology and the testimonies I've heard from many Christians. My simple message here is that for a secular person who won't have that same grounding for listening to Jesus or that same motivation, there still is a really powerful and good reason to listen to Jesus and emulate Jesus. It's not because we might think that he's in some sense divine or the Son of God. It's because the teachings are of such incredibly and consistently high quality. And when we map them onto what's going on in our lives and in our culture, we can see how transformative they are. And as I say in the book, we can see that these are things that the world needs now. And I think those are darn good reasons, actually, for following Jesus, even though they're secular reasons.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to at all take away from, again, my great appreciation for what you're seeking to do here, Tom. I mean, I don't mean to intend any kind of disregard for your pursuit. I'll just come back to the borrowed capital and the fume idea. And I don't say this with lament or, you know, wringing my hands, crying over it. I'm a Bonhoeffer fan, and he talked about, you know, a secular age and a non-religious spirituality. I have real interest in that kind of discussion. Having said that, but I do think the borrowed capital, the fumes come into play, that I think it's drawing from Jesus's import without the transcendent foundations which made even the ethical import of Jesus possible. We've talked about that. No doubt we'll come back to that. And I think that's an ongoing conversation. So it's...
No doubt. So much to say about that.
Yeah. So the last question before we wrap it up is, while fascinating and vitally important as an exercise in seeking to illustrate or demonstrate the significance of Jesus in our secular age, I can't help but think, and we've been getting at this in one way or another, that you're trying to have your cake and eat it too. How would you respond? And I don't even know if you like cake, but how would you respond, Tom?
In what sense, have my cake and eat it too? Going the easy way, taking the parts of Jesus that I like and skipping the other parts?
Well, I don't think you're trying to take it easy. I don't think you're a guy who takes things easy, so I don't mean it in some kind of glib, easy manner. That's not how you operate. I know you well enough to know that's not the case. But go ahead. If you need further explanation, let me know.
For the longest time, over the course of my adult life, I was really troubled by this question of whether it was legit for me to be inspired by Jesus or really say that the ethics of Jesus were at the center of my own ethical life and my understanding of myself, how I treat people, and so forth. And I started to think that it just wasn't allowed because I couldn't muster traditional God belief. And so I started to, in a resigned way, just think that, you know, Jesus was off limits for me. And then I decided to heck with that. And I wasn't going to be stopped by my lack of traditional God belief. And if Jesus is the exemplar and the vehicle for what I find to be the best set of ethical teachings and insights, the best example of how to live and treat other people, well, I'm going to engage with the figure of Jesus, mm-hmm. even though technically I'm not supposed to. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how that responds to your question, but when I think about this conversation and what I've been going through with my own journey in writing this book, that was really the point that I came to, and that's what I'm up to.
Thank you, Tom.
And if that's the cake, it's a really good cake. And I'm glad that I'm partaking.
Thank you. And I appreciate the answer. You know, and again, we could go at it from a variety of angles, and perhaps we'll have opportunity in the future to take it up.
Yes, there's so much more we can say about this. I can't wait.
Well, what I would want to affirm, and it's a point that you make in the book in certain respects, that is, I mean, Christians don't have the corner on Jesus. I mean, he doesn't put himself in anyone's box. So it's not as if I'm wishing to say here, you know, you can't have my Jesus. I mean, you know, he's not my Jesus to dole out or keep
that's
to myself.
That's so well stated, yes.
Yeah, so that I just feel that that's not the cause of my concern. It's more what I take to be the theologic of his own self-understanding and the like. Having said that, I look forward to asking you more questions, Tom, in future interviews on this very thought-provoking, fresh, and timely work. If only I could interview you and St. Augustine, author of Another Form of Confessions Together, you sure make for great bookends to this theologian's musings.
Well, we have great technological advances, but to my knowledge, not one that could allow us to have a Skype conversation between you and me and Augustine. That's unfortunate.
Well, thank you, Tom. Blessings to you, and I look forward to keeping the conversation going.
Thank you so much, Paul, and thanks for everything you're doing to advance the conversation across the country.
Thanks, Tom.
It's really important.
Okay, all the best.
You too.
This is Paul Lewis Metzger, author of the blog, columnist at Consuming Jesus, and also Uncommon God, Common Good at Pathos, director of New Wine, New Wineskins, speaking with Thomas Krademacher, Tom Krademacher, Confessions of a Secular Jesus Follower, Finding Answers in Jesus for Those Who Don't Believe. All the best. Goodbye.